All right, so our Tuesday night Bible study turned into early Wednesday morning. If you hadn't heard, me and the family are sick with a stomach bug. I'll spare you the details, but I'd been sleeping all day. Now I feel a little bit better, so I'm up late getting this Tuesday Bible study done. Because I figured, even though we didn't meet tonight, it gives us a chance to take advantage of some of the new software we're implementing. And also allows me to record this for your use at a future date. And so we're picking up in Genesis 28. And if you didn't know, every Tuesday we alternate chapter from the Old Testament, chapter from the New Testament. This is the Old Testament week. And we left off with, in 27, Jacob stealing the blessing of Isaac, having to leave town in a hurry, and Rebekah saying to Isaac that she hates her life because of the Hittite or Canaanite women that he's marrying. And if Jacob marries a similar woman, what good will we, the ESV says, what good will my life be to me? And so that's where 28 picks up. And so looking at Genesis 28, starting in verses 1 through 2, we get the kind of the introduction to what this chapter is going to be about. Remember, Isaac was kind of, even though he was a patriarch and he was important, he was kind of a transition between Abraham and Jacob. We don't get as in-depth with Isaac as we get with Abraham and Jacob. And so now we're moving the narrative along to Jacob's journey, Jacob's travels, and Jacob's life. And it starts off with Genesis 28, 1 and 2. Then Isaac called Jacob and blessed him and directed him, "You must not take a wife from the Canaanite women. Arise, go to Padan Aram, to the house of Bethuel, your mother's father, and take as your wife from there one of the daughters of Laban, your mother's brother." And so Jacob was commanded to take a wife from Laban. Remember, this is important because at some level, Genesis is being used as propaganda. If we believe Moses wrote it, and he wrote it before they entered into the promised land, at some level, this is a form of propaganda to encourage the Israelites to take the promised land from the Canaanites. And so with Jacob going to get a wife outside of the territory of the region, he is removing any Canaanite lineage or claim to the land. The Israelites are the ones who had it promised to them. It was promised to specific people, and those specific people did not have Canaanite origins. And Esau has already taken a wife from the region, and so he's already kind of messed up that ability. And so again, it's fitting that Jacob becomes the blessed son in which the promise is carried through, the promise that was given to Abraham. And we'll see that promise kind of pop up again here a couple times in this chapter, because it's an important, it's the driving force for everything they're doing. Remember, the Israelites are on the edge of the promised land, all because the promise given to Abraham, which was passed on to Isaac, and now will be passed on to Jacob. And so in 28:3 through 5, we see God Almighty bless you, and this is Isaac talking to Jacob, and make you fruitful and multiply you, that you may become a company of peoples. May he give the blessing of Abraham to you and to your offspring with you, that you may take possession of the land of your sojournings that God gave to Abraham. Thus Isaac sent Jacob away, and he went to Padan Aram to Laban the son of Bethuel, the Aramean, the brother of Rebekah, Jacob and Esau's mother. So Jacob is going to get a wife the same place that Isaac got a wife from. And so the blessing of Abraham is repeated by Isaac, and we see that this is a motivating factor for the decisions that Isaac is making and the things that he's doing. and it seems to have even taken the form of a formal blessing. Isaac is very much promising Jacob, or passing on the promise to Jacob that his father passed on to him. And so we see that this is kind of like a family blessing that is given to the descendants. And then remember, the promise is the three most important things that is in the life of an ancient Near Eastern person. You have the promise of descendants, the promise of land, and the promise of religion. And we remember that's everything that Abraham left his family for. He had all that stuff in his old home, but God called him out and gave him new descendants, new land, and a new religion. And so, this is the blessing of Abraham. This is the blessing of Abraham being restated, and the same promises are there. And so in Genesis 28, 6 through 9, now Esau saw that Isaac had blessed Jacob and sent him away to Paddan Aram to take a wife from there, and that as he blessed him, he directed him, you must not take a wife from the Canaanite women, and that Jacob had obeyed his father and his mother and had gone to Paddan Aram. So when Esau saw that the Canaanite women did not please Isaac his father, Esau went to Ishmael and took as his wife, besides the wife he had, Mahalath, the daughter of Ishmael, Abraham's son, the sister of Nebaioth. I don't know if I pronounced that right, but it's got to be close, right? And so Esau is contrasted against Jacob here. You have Jacob leaving the land to get a wife, so that no Canaanite claim can be done to the promised land. The Edomites under Esau do not deserve the promised land because they've already kind of ruined that pure claim that the patriarchs have on the land of Israel. And so Jacob obeyed and Esau disobeyed. And so it gets a little bit deeper here in the text than just the very simple what many of my Reformed friends like to just say, Jacob I loved and Esau I hated. We begin to see the backstory behind that statement. And then we see that since the Canaanite women did not please Isaac, and this is the first time we actually see Isaac. Before, it was his wife who didn't like the Canaanite women. But now we're seeing Isaac had a similar opinion, and the ESV says did not please, but also a fitting translation is that the Canaanite women were evil. And so I don't know exactly what that would be tied into if we were to use the word evil, but there is a separation between the quality of women that could be found in the Canaanite land and the quality of woman that Jacob has to go. And I don't mean quality of woman as in some were better wives and some were, but it would be, I guess you would say, evil for Jacob to taint the promise by allowing the Canaanites to have some form of claim on the legacy. And then we see Esau attempting to imitate Jacob by going to a distant relative, Ishmael, for a wife, but he doesn't go far enough really necessary, and he's already kind of out of the loop on it. It's kind of like when he comes back to the tent and he asks Isaac in the last chapter, Father, don't you have a blessing for me? In the same way, Esau is just trying to give a bad imitation of where the blessing and the promise has already landed on Jacob. And so when we get to verses 10 and 11, we begin to see Jacob travel throughout the land. And so Jacob left Beersheba and went toward Haran, and he came to a certain place and stayed there that night because the sun had set. Taking one of the stones of the place, he put it under his head and lay down in that place to sleep. And so we see Jacob sets out for a 500-mile journey. It's kind of, we see earlier that the way it's explained is left Beersheba and went towards Haran. It sounds like a quick jaunt in our English translation, but this is 500 miles. And we see also the urgency that was given in 27, Jacob's mom telling him to leave to go to her brother for the safety of his life doesn't seem to really be present in chapter 28, meaning leading some scholars to think that this is two different accounts that were combined later. I don't know necessarily. This is probably one of the best places where that argument kind of fits and runs through. But either way, we're getting where the last chapter was focused on how Jacob become the heir of the promise. We now get the actual details of how he's going to fulfill that promise. And so he probably traveled well-known trade routes going north. Haran is north of where Beersheba is. And then he stops at Bethel to rest near the beginning of his journey. And so here's a couple maps here for you to take a look. This is the total 500-mile trek that Jacob is getting ready to take. See him starting in Beersheba there and then moving all the way up to Haran. And then those little crosses you see is the region of Padan Aram. And so, or Padan Aram. And so we see that he's going back to his homeland. Remember, this is the place where Abraham's father left Ur and traveled north and settled before Abraham was called out and was pulled into the promised land. Well, Abraham's family settled there in that region. And as you can see by the rivers all around it, it was probably a somewhat populated region for many people to settle due to the availability of the natural resources around them. And so when we look closer, this is the jaunt that we see. He stops at Bethel, and we'll find out later the name is Bethel. He stops at Bethel to rest for the night, and this is the southern end of the promised land. Beersheba extends almost to the very southern end. Bethel is just north of Jerusalem, but remember, if we look at the southern portion of the Dead Sea and the northern portion of the Sea of Galilee, that gives us kind of an outline of the nation of Israel. We're barely out of the region of the Dead Sea. He's still in the region kind of the Jordan. He's walking, looks like the highway takes him through the hill country, through Jerusalem area, to Luz or Bethel. And so this is going to be in Genesis 28:12-15. We run into a popular portion of the Bible that's actually referenced by Jesus in John chapter, 150s, and we'll see here. I can pull up the cross reference here, I'm sure, in a second. But we see the tale of Jacob's ladder. And he dreamed, and behold, there was a ladder set up on the earth, and the top of it reached to heaven, and behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it. Important words there. Stood above it. Also, acceptable translation would be stood beside him. But I think stood above it is the better sense for this passage. And said, I am the Lord, the God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie, I will give to you and to your offspring. Your offspring shall be like the dust of the earth, and you shall spread abroad to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south. And in you, your offspring, shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Behold, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go, and will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. And so we see Jacob's stairway, and the term stairway is a better fit than Jacob's ladder, because the idea of the angels climbing up and down the ladder doesn't really make much sense, and especially when we know more about Mesopotamian, Babylonian culture and ancient Near Eastern culture, it was probably a ziggurat, which is probably also what the best definition of the Tower of Babel would be, which was literally a kind of a elevated temple with a staircase going up the outside of it, and it was meant to be a place where the gods could come down and go back up into heaven. And that's why the Tower of Babel was so offensive to God, is because they're building this temple where they feel like they're going to be able to kind of come through and reach the divine realm. And we'll look at a little bit later at what that looks like. And actually, I can't really bring that up right now, but there's, you have to remember that the ancient Near Eastern mind divided the world by various segments, and more so than what we do, where we think of heaven and then we think of space and we have the atmosphere separate. They had below and above them, humanity occupied this middle space where below them was Sheol, or death, where people got pulled down into when they died. And even below that is where you had the primordial kind of chaos that creation was made of. And then even above them, depending on what figure you're looking at, it could be one, two, or three different elements. But this is where the gods kind of had their domain above them, up in the clouds and up into the heights. And then if you want to look at it even from a Jewish ancient Near Eastern mindset, for them, you had kind of the realm where the sun occupied, which was kind of deified, and then even above that was God's realm, and then surrounding everything underneath the throne of God was the primordial chaos waters in which the ancient Near Eastern mind feared. Chaos was the biggest problem. And so the ziggurat represented one of the ways in which the gods crossed over these realms or barriers down into reach man. And this was a common Mesopotamian and Babylonian idea of stairways connecting heaven and earth. And I want you to remember what was said there. God was standing, and that's an important image for the mind. And this is where it kind of breaks off from traditional ancient Near Eastern thoughts on God, where oftentimes at the top of the ziggurat, the god Marduk was seen as sitting and kind of inactive, where Yahweh is standing as the angels are descending and ascending up the stairway. And so this paints a picture of an active God, one who is active in creation. And it goes back into the original split of thought between early kind of Israelite thoughts, ancient Near Eastern thoughts on God, and the rest of the ancient Near Eastern region, where most other religions believed humanity was created to be the slaves of God and we did all the work, where Yahweh, even seen in the Abrahamic promise, is seen as the God who takes the burden of all the work upon himself to fulfill and complete his promise, as we saw with him restating, or we will see with him restating it here soon. And so this is an example of a pretty ornate Babylonian ziggurat. And even when I was deployed into Iraq, we would see there was an ancient one. I've been to the area that used to be Nineveh. Now it's called Samarra, I believe. I think I'll have to check the map again to see. It's been a while. The names get all mixed up. And it was a circular kind of almost pyramid shape like this, but it was more circular. It didn't have any 90 degree angles. And then a circular stairway or ramp that led up the ziggurat to the top. And again, this was the idea of, this is the pathway God takes to get down from heaven and from earth. Now remember, this was given to Jacob in a dream. And so this wasn't God saying, this is literally how I get up and down from heaven into earth. it was using an image that Jacob would understand to see how God is actively working and his agents are actively working on his behalf. And that was part of the promise. He tells him, I will maintain this promise with you until we see it through. And so God restates the promise. And this is not a generic family blessing, maybe like what we saw earlier, but it is God himself restating the same promise he gives to Abraham. And he uses different terms like, I'll spread you out like dust on the land. But it was basically the same promise of religion, land, and descendants, the three most important things to the ancient Near Eastern man. And then he also bears the burden of the promise, which Jacob completely misses. And so in 16 through 19, we see Jacob awoke from his sleep and said, surely the Lord is in this place, and I did not know it. And he was afraid and said, how awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven. So early in the morning, Jacob took the stone that he had put under his head, set it up for a pillar, and poured oil on the top of it. He called the name of that place Bethel, but the name of the city was Luz at the first. And so we see Jacob's reaction. He sets up an altar there to worship God, which was a common thing. We've seen Abraham do similar kind of responses to run-ins with God. And we see him build a pillar, which is a common worship device. We'll see that play more so in Judges when they have to go in and tear down the Asherah poles later in the Bible, and also in Samuel too. We see them having to go through, and just to kind of fill you in, the Asherah poles were more than likely pillars of wood that were set up in high places in which the god Ishtar was worshipped, the female goddess of Assyria and Babylon and Mesopotamia. And she had a bunch of different names, but it was essentially the same goddess that got passed on to various. But anyways, the whole point is that this is a common worship practice in the ancient Near East. And we see him, though, kind of get fixated on the place more than the person. The area, he calls it the gate of heaven. So you can see him saying, okay, this is the place God can come from heaven to earth. And that's not necessarily the point that Yahweh's trying to make, is that this is necessarily a holy ground. It was more restating the promise to Jacob. But Jacob is fixated on, I got to keep this place sacred because this is obviously the place I can come see God. And he's overemphasizing the place. And the name even kind of shows it, because Bethel literally means Beth, house, El, God, house of God. It is the house of God. But we see him finish out the chapter by being kind of dense when he goes into, then Jacob made a vow saying, if God will be with me and will keep me in this way that I go, and will give me bread to eat and clothing to wear, so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then the Lord shall be my God, and this stone which I have set up for a pillar shall be God's house, and all that you give me, I will give a full tenth to you. And so we see Jacob's vow, and Jacob is actually the first patriarch to respond to God with a vow in return. The unfortunate thing is he's acting as if he can affect the promise, or as if he's an equal trading partner in this deal. God already told him, here's the promise I give to you. I'm going to be the one who keeps and maintains the promise. And then he wakes up and says, and basically gives a, if you do this, then I will trust you as God. And his vision is kind of narrow, because he's just worried about eating and clothes, missing the entire point of the promise, that is that this land is going to be a great nation and a great people, and it's going to be something that is magnificent and amazing. And he's like, as long as you give me eating and clothes, then we'll be good. And then just as a side note, the tithe is again mentioned. and I think this is the only time since Abraham it's been mentioned in Genesis, but it may show that either it was a tradition passed down by Abraham as a form of worship, or it may be in the customary gift for or within the ancient Near East. But then Jacob makes a statement that is very dangerous, where he says, if you give me these clothes and food, and I come back to my father's land safely, then the Lord shall be my God. And that's where we start getting into a scary place with Jacob, where he's always trying to finagle the deal out of it when the deal was already set. And for him to kind of approach this from a mindset as if he has a way or ability to change or affect the deal shows that Jacob has some serious theological issues he has to get resolved, which we'll see getting resolved through the rest of his life. And like we said a second ago, then the Lord shall be my God. Dangerous statement for any of us, even Christians, to make. If you do this, then you'll be my God. And again, it goes back to the temptation of Jesus, where it is like, who are we to put God to the test? And so in conclusion, if we're going to take some kind of modern practical application out of this, we can trust and know that God maintains his promise. And one of the things I'm going to be talking about this weekend on a Sunday morning is how not only does God maintain his promises, but he actually rigs the system so his promises are fulfilled by positioning us through various things in life. But we got to remember that means God is not idly sitting, but active in the affairs of his people. He cares for us, and it's the image of God standing, and even Stephen, when he's being stoned in Acts, and he's the martyr, and he sees the Son of Man stand up, he sees Jesus stand up from his throne, he is concerned with our affairs, and he actually acts on our behalf. But we have to remember that for us to earn God's allegiance, we have nothing to offer. All that was offered on our behalf. Just like with Abraham, as Christians, God took the burden of his promise on himself and made it to where it can be fulfilled with no real action on our part. We just come in faith and in worship. And so we need to remember as Christians, and it's a form of maturity that we need to kind of grow out of, we need to stop acting like we can bargain with God. His plan is his plan. And again, on Sunday, we're going to talk more in depth about it, because I don't take the traditional Baptist or strictly Reformed view of everything has already been written out, set in stone, and we're all just kind of automatons stumbling through all this. We serve an amazing God whose plan can work in the midst of our decision-making and our will. But the most important thing we have to remember is that Jesus Christ dying on the cross for our sins, justifying us, and working as a propitiation and an atonement is what earned God's allegiance, I guess you would say, towards us. And we accept that by faith. But there's nothing I can say where it's just like, well, God, if you just give me this and you give me that, then I'll worship you. Who are we to decide whether or not he deserves worship? And that's the whole entire point, is changing and making sure we don't have a view of God like Jacob, where we put these caveats or kind of like these deal breakers in there. Well, if you were really God, you would have done this for me, or you would have done that for me. And instead, focusing in on who he is and realizing he already took the burden of our sin. He's already cleared the path towards eternity with us. We have nothing we can offer, that, and he has nothing more to show to us that says he deserves more of our commitment. And so that is Genesis 28. Next week we'll be in the book of John, and I'll have to look up and see what... I think we're in John chapter 10. I can't remember if we ended up hitting John chapter 9 or not. But we may be in John 9 or John 10. I'll have to look it up again. But either way, we'll move through the New Testament next week and then come back to Genesis 29 the week after. And all of these are going to be stored on our Faith Life website and portal and all that. And so not only will it be stored in our community through Faith Life, if you go to Crossroads Wesleyan Church through Faith Life and join that group, you'll be able to find these studies and my sermons there. But you will also be able to go, if you go to Faith Life Sermons, you can find them there. And then even if you have the most basic logos, you can get on and get access to the notes form of my sermon, where I've taken the notes and all that. And so you can see the outline, basically, that we have set up for these Bible studies and these sermons. And so that being said, I'm finally think I'm talked myself into being ready to go to bed. So I hope you guys have a great night and a great morning by the time you're seeing this, maybe in the afternoon. And I look forward to seeing you real soon. And as soon as we kick this stomach bug, I don't know if Wednesday night, tomorrow night, we'll end up having our Wednesday night family night, because this thing spread through our family within 2 days. Everyone was just throwing up everywhere. But I don't want to risk passing that on to the congregation. So tomorrow night, Wednesday night, is still up in the air. But even if that doesn't happen, we will still have a presentation like this available. Anyways, I'm done rambling. You guys have a great night. God bless, and I'm praying for all of you. Thank you.